Welcome to WebRush, the weekly talk show that brings you stories of real-world development from industry experts and developers like you and me. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallin, Craig Shoemaker, and John Papa find out what it takes to write, deploy, and maintain apps that stand up to the demands of the real world. And now, here are your hosts.
Welcome back to WebRush. This is episode 147. Wow. Long time we've been on the air now, 3 years worth. And today, my name's John Pop, along with my hosts, Ward, Dan, and Craig. We have a special guest on today, a return guest of Jem Young. How you doing, Jem?
I'm okay. I'm glad to be on, and I'm looking forward to the conversation we're going to have today, no matter which direction it takes us.
How many directions do you like to go in at once? Because we can really enable that.
I like at least four or five threads going on at certain times, but I also appreciate the loop back at the end when I'm like, oh, wait, I have one last thought on that thing we brought up 20 minutes ago. That's how I like to have conversations. It's really efficient.
Awesome.
I'm hoping you're going to be able to shed some light on the fact that your GitHub profile has a picture of you with an Emmy in your hand. What's the story behind that?
Yes. So it was a photo op. I did no work, as a proper manager does, but I posed for the picture, again, taking credit, as a proper manager does. But no, that was the Emmy for Outstanding Technical Achievement, I want to say, for our work in subtitling that the team did.
Nice.
I had nothing to do with that. I'm just posing with it. I hope to win.
There's
an Emmy
award
someday.
For subtitling, Jem? Come on. Really?
They're not as glamorous because, you know, engineers get them. So, you
know,
obviously.
How can it not be glamorous to get an award for subtitling?
We, at Netflix, we feel very strongly on accessibility and the work that goes into subtitling. I don't know if you've ever heard a title with audio description, but it's available on a lot of our titles. I encourage you to turn it on because it's fascinating, because it describes what's happening. So if you're watching House of Cards, it'll be... Kevin Spacey's character walks into a room. It's a dark room. He looks around. And, like, they describe what's happening.
We had that on by accident one time, and everybody was freaking out because we're just like, who's talking? This is not a character. What's happening here?
But if you can't see what's happening, it's a...
Yes.
Because of any sort of impairment or...
Sure.
It's just nice to have. When I had a son last year during the pandemic, who's now 17 months, but during that time... Being able to turn on subtitles easily and, like, I can still watch a show while he's sleeping in the background. It's, I don't know. That's how I feel about accessibility. It benefits us all. And I'm really proud of the team that they've won awards based on, like, the work they've done in that area.
I accidentally turned on the audio piece one time and I was surprised as well. But the piece I always have on actually these days is the closed captioning. I like the subtitles, especially when you're watching something like Game of Thrones on HBO Max or Go or whatever the HBO streaming thing is. I like it. Or The Witcher on Netflix, since we're talking Netflix. Some of the names of the people, when they say them, I don't know what they are.
You're like, what? Yep. That's exactly why we turn it on. Sometimes there's an accent and I'm like, I didn't catch that.
And you got to think of people.
You know, you read the subtitle.
And in my house.
You know how this is going to ruin things? Like, suppose there's a song and you always thought it said, there is a bathroom on the right. Now you're going to actually know what it is. You're never going to have...
Wait, I thought CCR song was There's
Excuse
a Bathroom
me,
on the
kiss
Right.
The sky.
You and me and Leslie. I always wondered that, you know, you and me and Leslie. What's Leslie doing there? But anyway, all right, this is the march of technology.
Before we kick too much in the show today, I want to make sure we introduce Jem to everybody out there who may not be as familiar with him as we are. Jem Young is an engineering manager on the web platform for Netflix. He's the co-host of Front End Happy Hour. He's a member of TC39, an instructor on Front End Masters. And he says he's taller in real life, which wouldn't be hard when compared to me, because I think I'm about the shortest person you all know. So welcome to the show, Jem.
Thanks, John.
So we talked about when we were going to get you on the show, a lot of things. One of the great things I appreciate about you is you're very real. You're very practical. Both in your social media, on your podcast, and when we've chatted in person, you seem to have a very practical view of how technology and things are working. So I wanted to get you on to talk about WebAssembly originally and think about where is that heading, because you made some comments about that. And and some experience in that area. But I think in the last year or so, you became an engineering manager. Am I correct?
That's correct. About 2 months ago, actually.
Okay, so even more recent, yeah. And you must be having to think, especially at Netflix, one of the leading companies out there for technology, there must be a lot of decisions you have to make in hiring and what technologies to choose, how the web is progressing, not only what to adopt, but also what not to adopt as you go forward. So I wanted to kind of just start in that particular area, and maybe we could start with a topic of your choice out of that.
Oh, man. You just listed like a bunch of different threads we could pull on. Let's start at a high level with trying to debug modern technology, or let's say the challenge of understanding it. So back in the day, there was one choice, and that was jQuery. And we all said, that's pretty good. This is all we need for the rest of our lives. And there was one browser. So, you know, we're all good. Now we have a plethora of browsers, a multiplicity of tools. So it's even more challenging. And then you combine that with the noise that we get now from areas like developer relations, which are people that are paid to go out and talk about the technology. So you wonder how authentic those interactions are. You have people that are going for Twitter fame or YouTube fame or something like that. So they have strong biases and opinions. You have open source creators who obviously are going to try to influence you to use their technology and say it's better than the other technologies. So it's a tricky landscape to develop in. And I really feel bad for people that are new to the field, because you come in and you're like, what should I use? And then everybody's going to have their own opinion based on whatever biases or even prejudices that they have against one technology or the other. And that's coming into a new team as a manager. That is a real challenge that I face today, especially when I look at the web platform and Netflix and where we want to evolve it. And not just the next year or two, the next 5 years. What's technology that's going to hold up over time? And how best can we position my team so that it supports other engineers so that they can build with the latest and greatest technology if that's what they want to build. But mostly, how are they going to build things in the way that they feel is most productive?
Hey, are you building apps in React, Angular, Node, or some other framework? Well, with NX, you can build your full stack apps in a shared monorepo, integrate with modern tools, and reinforce best practices. You'll get advanced code generation and automatically configured tooling like Cypress, Jest, and Prettier that will simplify your workflow. NX also helps you simplify the relationships between applications and shared libraries to make it easier to share more code and develop more consistently across teams. And the best part is, you'll build higher quality apps and spend less time on configuration. So visit nx.dev to get Narwhal's popular open source toolkit for monorepo development today.
So just to kind of orient people on the types of systems that you work on, what are there certain features that we would recognize? Are you working on backend systems? Like, what area of technology are you touching?
So I work in the ill-defined area, even now in 2021, of the backend for the front end, which it's kind of wild after all this time, we still don't have a good name for it. So we're just going to stick with that. Essentially, my team runs the platform and infrastructure that powers Netflix.com. So we support about 60 plus UI engineers who are building features and A/B tests and bug fixes and new applications for Netflix.com. So the view of our team is a little bit further removed from the UI layer. We have less opinions when it comes to UI because that's not our area of expertise. We leave that to people that are much smarter and much more talented in that area. What we really want to unlock is the potential for teams to build how they want. So our stack is Node.js. It's a large Node.js application that we are slowly breaking to more of a platform. Whereas before, it was a monolith, as Node.js applications tend to get. And all these different teams. So we have all these different teams are working on it. So we have the streaming side, which most people are familiar. You go into Netflix.com. You watch The Witcher or Stranger Things or something like that. So that's one side that we support. We also support the non-member experience, which you've probably all been through. At some point, you've signed up for Netflix.com or you've logged in. that's an entirely different team. And those are two different applications with totally different needs in terms of bandwidth and the resources they're looking for, the type of support they need. So the challenge of my team working in a Node.js with a React front end based system is, how do we best position the platform so that it supports both of these teams and their unique needs? And that's where we sit.
So, Jim, you said something a while back, or at least I think you said something a little bit earlier, that kind of got me, threw me off my lunch, which is...
Do you need to go clean that up first, Ward, or are we okay?
I don't want to bring it up, John, literally. No, you said something about looking for people who want to work on the latest, greatest technology. I don't know whether you said that or not, but I know that's something that developers sometimes say they want. And maybe that's a difference between a young developer and somebody who's been around a while, because that wouldn't be my recommendation, especially in the face of the problem you set out, which is that there's so many choices. I don't think that would be how I would approach it. I don't think I would be looking for a job where I could work with the latest, greatest technology. I would want to be looking for a job where they're solving interesting problems, a problem that interested me. And then whatever technology they bring to bear is, hey, that's my entree. But I want to is the problem interesting? Is the effect of what, can I make a difference in somebody's life? Something like that would be what at least I would recommend to a young developer some developer who doesn't know the tech to go get. I mean, that's my position. Does that resonate with you at all?
Yeah, and you're laying out the case of the junior versus senior engineer right there. When we were all young once, we probably took pride in working in the latest and greatest and the bleeding edge. And hey, did you see the alpha just came out? And you're texting each other late at night, and you know you're in the middle of that. And as you grow in seniority and maturity, you realize now we're building systems that people depend on, that they rely on. The bleeding edge is not where we want to be. And I think that's one of the big misconceptions about large tech companies, is that they're always on the bleeding edge and they're pushing the bounds forward. And that's true to some degree, but not in the direction that you think. I don't know of any large, mature engineering organizations that are on, like, I don't know, the alpha version of React. Because anybody with some experience is going to know, on the bleeding edge, you're going to get cut. And when you have people that are depending on that, making their livelihoods, or you have production critical systems, you can't be there. So when it comes to people that I look for my team when I'm hiring, or any other team, is, like you said, it's impact. Yeah, we don't need to be on the bleeding edge, but what I really want to do is have an impact, and I want to shape that future vision of where we're going to go. So yeah, well captured, Ward.
What's your thoughts there, Jim, when it comes to how do you know you're not on the bleeding edge? I mean, it's easy to say we're not going to do betas. That's one way. But do you, at either your team or at Netflix in general, do you have a process you go through to evaluate before you make that jump? Or is it because someone senior up said, make the jump and you do it?
No, great, great question. And, you know, probably before I moved into management, I would be like, that's silly. Of course, there's one way to do things. But it's because I've been at Netflix for 5.5 years. I'm used to a different process. But engineering efforts at Netflix are engineer driven, which I realize now is a different way of doing engineering from other ways, where the manager or the director or the VP is kind of the thought leader for the group. And they're dictating down, like, hey, I just heard about Next.js. I heard that's hot. I want you all to go out and build that. I don't view that as the most optimal way of doing things. So when it comes to adopting new technology, it's all engineering driven. It's what the people on my team say. And I tell them all the time, I say, I am the worst software engineer on this team. So you all know much better than I do. So like, tell me what the pain points are. Tell me about the technology solutions you've heard about. And let's talk through the pros and cons. And then from there, I'll do my own research and say like, hey, yeah, this is a well-supported project. Or, you know, this actually seems to be end of life. Or this is only popular temporarily because of some company or another pushing technology. I'm sure you all can list plenty of examples of technologies that were really hot at a time and are no longer. Dart is a good example of something that people were like, oh, this
hey, that's making a comeback. Dart's making a comeback.
Any day now. Any day now.
So, Jim, I want to build on one part of Dan's question, because there's a lot of our audience out there who are technologists, folks like myself as well, who maybe they see a technology that has a lot of promise in their organization, and they're trying to figure out how to get that technology into the pipeline of what they're building. We'll use Next.js as an example, as you just mentioned. Maybe they have some website, it's undergoing some direction for some maintenance or redesign or just some upgrades, and they want to use Next.js in there. What's the right way for a technology team? Because you're saying grassroots is a good way for you to listen to people. What's the right way for them to communicate with their leaders, as opposed to what's a way you'd be like, please don't do that?
I think coming in saying, we have to adopt this. This is critical for the health and efficiency of our organization, that we have to adopt this technology, is the wrong approach. Because as a software engineering manager, I'm striking that balance between technology, but also business needs. And as much as I'd love to refactor large parts of our code base to TypeScript or something other than some of those pain points we have right now, I'm aware that there's a finite number of engineering hours I can allocate towards problems. So I need to solve business problems and I need to solve technology problems. The right way to approach someone with, when you're saying like, hey, I want to adopt this new technology, is what problems does this currently solve? What does this unlock for the team? Are we going to need to hire talent to come in and tell us how to use the technology best, or are we positioned to learn that? But also, what's the business case for this? Tell me, is this going to make developers more productive? Is this going to make the website faster? Is this going to allow us to build apps and iterate much quickly in the future and ship things? Those are the right questions to ask when it comes to...
Well, let me give you a real example, too, that I'm sure you've dealt with. You use React and Node on your stacks there today, correct? So React has a new version every once in a while. Node has a version with LTS every once in a while. There's also Current with Node, LTS and Current. Pick one or the other. How do you decide when it's time to go from like Node 14 to Node 16, for example? And do you look at the risk reward of, if we don't go to this version, here's what could happen? You know, because some companies wait 4, 5, 6 versions before they migrate, and then they end up in a world of pain. But what is that line? Like, how do you evaluate how quickly to stay towards that lead?
Generally, it's going to be a lot of business cases. So I look at what's the cost of the migration. That's probably the first thing I ask. Like, if there's a tool out there and it code mods everything for me, and we have a lot of tests in place to make sure that the migration went successfully, then usually I'll say do it, because the cost is low. And the higher the cost of something, of a migration or adopting a new technology, the more I'm going to press on, is this necessary? Is this going to advance the business? Is this going to advance the engineering side of things? Node is a great example. We go for the LTS versions for obvious reasons. As much fun as I'd have on the bleeding edge and the alpha stages of Node, and developers will be happy. So I'm like, hey, now you can use top level awaits and you don't have to wrap them in async functions anymore. That's awesome. However, in a year from now, when they're on the next version of Node because they're not supporting that anymore, that means we have to do a migration. And then the year after, we have to do another migration. Whereas the LTS, it's stable, it's consistent, it's going to receive security patches for the next couple of years. That's where we are. Because as much fun as I'd love always adapting new technology, we just can't spend all of our time there. And it's a trade-off that we're explicit about. And I say with the team, I'm like, hey, I know you want to build things. You're engineers. That's what we do. And I know you want to build greenfield projects, stuff that's never been done before. And I want that for you. And I will do my best to get that for you. But there's a balance we have to strike in that, you know, we're a $200 billion company with people with that rely on us. You know, they want to make sure that when they come to Netflix.com, they're having a bad day or whatever's happening in their life, that they can just go ahead and watch that show. And it's our job to provide that for them. So we have to make these trade-offs. And I just be explicit with the team and all of my technology partners. And same goes for them. They're like, hey, Jim, we're using GraphQL now. And I'll be like, okay, why? And if someone's like, oh, because it's hot, then I'm probably going to have a more serious conversation with them about their motivations. And I'm going to press on them to give me like more rigor in what around that decision. And the same goes for me. I expect other teams at Netflix to hold me accountable when I say, like, hey, we're going to refactor our web platform to use whatever's the latest, hottest thing now. I want them to press me on it. I want them to challenge that decision, because I really feel when people challenge and dissent is when we have the proper decisions. When everybody's all aligned and we're all like, yes, this is the way forward, I question if we're making the right decision. I want a lot of, not a lot, but I want disagreements, and I want us to push on any decision we make. And that's the level that I hope everybody can operate at.
How easy or hard is it for you to, like, you recognize there's a need for refactoring, you don't want to incur technical debt. How often are you fighting that battle, and how much of it of a battle is it for you when you're dealing with your managers?
Again, so a bit on Netflix culture, because it is engineering driven, I don't have challenges with my manager, who is a director, as other managers. My manager never questions the decisions I make. He'll say, interesting, why are you doing that? And he'll seek information and context around the choices we make. So I say, hey, we're migrating our APIs from Java to Node.js. And he'll say, okay, why is that necessary right now? Not in a way that's challenging, just in a, he seeks to understand. And that's the same I apply to my team. They're like, hey, we need to do this. Okay, why? Is that motivated because our partners are complaining that we're not developing fast enough and this is a bottleneck, or this is a large source of technical debt and it's just, you know, we're paying the interest on it every single time we build a new feature and we just need to pay off this debt. So it's a balance. And again, it goes back to that conversation of, what's our goal and who are we supporting? Is it glory? Is it we want to build things for the sake of building things? We want to just like re-architect things and have a good blog post and we can tweet about it and we're like, yeah, look how great Netflix platform team is. Or is it to support the engineers and help them build more?
No, the first one. Absolutely the first one.
Yeah. Glory, yes. Man. It's all glory. You got to go for the glory.
You had me at having fun.
We are the champions, my friend. Right.
By the way, I want to let folks know we're adding a bunch of links into the show notes from our topics here. And one of the things I added to the links, maybe Jem, I'm not sure. You said it's okay if I surprise you with questions, but here's a question for you. I added this to the links. It's the Netflix engineering team on Twitter. Is that you behind that? Is that some other folks? Because I find that a great follow on Twitter.
And you know why it's a great follow is because it's run by a friend of yours, Ryan Burgess, who is my former manager, the co-host of Front End Happy Hour podcast, and like someone who is absolutely responsible for where I am in my career. I can't speak enough high praises about what a great leader Ryan is. And the way he shows up running the Netflix Twitter account and just his engagement in the community is reflective of his character and who he is. And that's why it's great. It's because Ryan is great. So I have very little to do with the Netflix engineering podcast, though I am going to be taking over one of our Twitter accounts because I'm a manager now and I can do that. And nobody can stop me. So
you should take over the Netflix Twitter account.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't actually know who runs that, funny enough. Maybe marketing? I don't know. But the Netflix engineering accounts are all run by engineers, not any sort of, we don't have developer relations. We don't have, those roles don't exist within our company. So if you see it on Netflix and it's engineering related, it's because there's an engineer out there who cares.
I sense, Jim, that you have some antipathy to DevRel. Can you, since so many of the hosts here, not me, are DevRel people, can you elaborate on that?
Ward, I wouldn't call it antipathy. It's more I'm cautious in understanding the role in the tech ecosystem, specifically in the UI realm, where technology tends to move a little bit faster than in other areas. To me, it's about awareness and intent. So I'm on the WebRush podcast. I have no intent other than a good conversation. I'm not selling you anything. I'm not trying to like pimp my open roles or anything like that. I'm not trying to get you to work at Netflix. I'm not trying to promote.
Sponsored by Jem Young's Netflix team.
Sponsored by Jem Young's beard. Jem Young's beard cream. Make your beard grow like Jem Young.
Which I could not do, by the way.
Me neither.
What if you had my beard cream? Guarantee to grow a beard. Man, woman, child, you need a beard? Jem's beard cream will do it for you. No, I have no ulterior motive here other than just, you know, engaging with people I don't always get a chance to connect with. And then hopefully some of our conversations inspire something in someone else. When it comes to developer relations, the intent there is a little different. You are paid by a company to promote either the engineering culture or a practice or a framework or even a way of thinking. And that's fine. In my younger years, I used to sneer at marketing. I'm like, who needs marketing? That's so dumb. Like, what? You know, in my arrogance of youth, I would say that that's a non-essential role. But now, as I'm older and more mature, I realize, who cares if you build the coolest, greatest technology in the world if nobody knows about it? And that's the case for a lot of projects. So you need developer relations. You need people to go out there and say, like, hey, we as a company built this, and we are great engineers, and here's an example of our great engineering. Here are the problems it solves. We think it can work for you. I have no problem with that. I think it's the shadow developer relations. What I call it is where it's not clear that they're being paid to promote a product or that's their job, literally, to say how great something is. It's not an unbiased opinion, is where it gets really, really murky for me and really hazy. I have no problem that the role exists. It's just, I think especially newer people to our field don't necessarily know that, hey, this person I respect wrote a blog post on how great this technology is. I'm going to adopt it. They don't have that understanding. I was like, yeah, maybe it is great. Maybe it'll solve all your problems. However, they are paid to say this, and they're not going to say otherwise. And that's where, yeah, it's a really hazy line.
Chime in there real quick.
Yeah, we're all going to respond at this point here, aren't we?
So,
I want to put a quick disclaimer out there. Dan and I both work for developer relations directly in the advocacy area. Craig works for a team called Developer Relations. He's on the doc writing team. And Ward has no relations with anybody in the world. So,
except for this podcast.
Developer anti-relations team.
Right. The developer antipathy team. Yes.
Right.
But let me circle back because I want to mention something.
I got to let you go, man. I got to go, Dan.
I totally agree with you, Jem. I've been in this role a year now. And John and I have actually talked about this. I'm like really sensitive to coming across as, I don't know, over enthusiastic or marketing, for example, salesy. It just drives me up the wall because for 20 years I ran a consulting company and I didn't deal with that. And we recently had a situation come up with some content we are going to publish from our team. And I felt it was great content, but I'm also a little scared that people would take that and assume that's gospel. Like, this is the way you should build everything. And I'll give you a hint. It's a way to do something without a database. And in many cases, you know how that goes. People abuse it. And next thing you know, you have, you know, multi-concurrent whatever situations, and now you're in trouble. So anyway, I just wanted to say I totally agree with you. I think the art, and John can chime in here, of this job, though, is adding value when value is justified, not selling people on something. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, I think this is a topic that we talked a little before the show to let our audience know. I think we decided we're going to do a show just on developer relations, and we'll probably invite Jem back to, we can talk more deep on this, but I'll give you the one thing I really feel strongly about in every developer relations role, whether it lives under marketing or not. And there's a great article, by the way, by a friend of ours, Kim Maeda, who's been on the show a few times. About what developer relations is and should it sit in marketing or not and how she feels about it. I'll tell you that the biggest thing I've found with DevRel is keeping and maintaining your authenticity is absolutely critical. If people don't trust you and you're not credible about what you're saying and doing, why would anybody ever listen to what you're saying and going. Because yes, you're right, Jim. It is about influencing and sharing and, you know, showing how things work. And in that sense, there's been an evolution. And every time we hire new people in, the one thing I always look at is, look, you know, never go out and talk about stuff unless you believe in it. If there's a product you don't feel is worthy of your community, don't talk about it like it is, but also don't just pee all over it. Meaning, find out what's wrong, find out what the community does need and bring that back inside. That's the real job in my mind of DevRel, is being that connection between the community and the product teams. What isn't the real role is the one I think we hear of most, Jim, and that's the, how many events can I fly to in a year and meet cool people and go out drinking and, you know, talk about technology and yada, yada, yada. It's something we do, but it's, that isn't what we center around. And if that's what you're centering around in DevRel, folks out there, what you aspire to, then yes, I'm opinionated on this. I feel like that's a bad way to go. And I'm 100% with you, Jim.
All right. So you guys all fell on your swords. Let's switch the direction of the question here. But
Jim is wise. What can we say?
I was actually going to say that it's a two-way street. If it's not a two-way street, it's really not developer relations. It's publicity.
Yeah, but if it's one way, it's marketing. If it's the other way, you're really not helping the company. So you got to do both.
But switching to something else, Jim, you're hiring, I understand.
Ward wants a job, by the way.
That's what I'm going to say. How do I get a job with you? And more specifically, how can I go in and blow the interview?
So you're saying, how can you do poorly on an interview with me?
Yeah, I just want you to, you know, share your thoughts on experiences. No, I'd just like, you're doing it, you're living it right now. You're living the hiring experience. And you must have some disappointments and some excitement about the kinds of things that come that you see. And what would you like to tell our audience about either of those?
I think my biggest tip from moving from individual contributor to a manager and my change of perspective on what hiring is there are a lot of really smart people in the world. They're incredible amounts of talent. And with the rise of remote work, it's unlocked so much more opportunities for people who haven't had it before. So I'm really excited about that. The challenging part is I have one role open and I have hundreds of applicants, which is, I guess, a good problem to have. But I have to sort through all these because when you go to Microsoft or a Netflix or a Google or large tech companies, the compensation packages are life altering, especially if you're moving from, you know, a startup to a bigger company. It literally, we are altering the trajectory of your life. They exclude compensation from that. The knowledge and impact you'll now have is so high. So I take hiring very, very seriously. And so it's really hard when I'm sorting through candidates and I'm like, well, I don't think they're qualified. I don't think they're qualified because I'm literally not allowing them that opportunity. But that's something I have to, it's a burden that I have to deal with sorting through. So I'd say the biggest tip for doing well is have more than your resume. Like, resume just tells me a snapshot of some of the things you do. If you give me more, like you have an active Twitter account or you have a blog or you give talks or you have another data point for me to sample, then maybe your resume isn't quite what I'm looking for. Maybe it doesn't have the skill sets that I think align with the role. However, if I go out and say, like, you know what? They don't have that, but they can speak really well to technology. And they're fearless communicators, and they're vulnerable, and they stay on the cutting edge. And they're really passionate about these particular bits of technology, but not quite what we're looking for. But I can shape them into what we need. That's good. That's what we want. But your question, Ward, was about how to not interview well.
It's both, really. I mean, it's fun to talk about how to screw, you know, blow the interview, but... Well, I guess don't lie about your skill set is probably one of the things that you would, that's a great way to blow it. But and people do. I mean, I was doing that same thing. And it's like, you say you know this, but you don't. bad idea. You know, there's an awful lot of people who have checked the boxes that you put out there. What are you going to do to stand out? And you're saying that the kinds of things that make somebody stand out are in the ways in which they communicate their what they do or their passion. Their ability to communicate seems to be something that you're looking for.
The more mature I get, the more I appreciate the operational side of engineering, the organizational side. The part that of engineering that isn't code, that is, hey, I see a problem, let me pull together all these teams and try to drive a resolution. The part that's you're out there writing documentation, totally underappreciated in our field. You're out there writing tests. You're making code easier for other people. What you really want is impact. And that's a really, I dig into that pretty quickly and decide, like, are you a coder? You just want to build features? And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Like, we all started as coders at some point. Or are you an engineer? And an engineer appreciates the organizational side of things, the person that's going to hold the meetings and make sure that people are hitting goals. And it doesn't often feel like you're engineering, because we think engineering is code. But really, it's a much larger process. And that's really what I'm trying to dig out when I talk to people is, do you understand that? Do you understand the importance of communication? Do you understand the importance of making trade-offs with partners and understanding their needs? And those aren't things that you can teach. Those are things that people either have picked up and they understand or they don't.
So if we look at the other side of that interviewing coin, one of the things that's popular to talk about in social media is how hard these interviews are, how unrealistic they are to the actual job. And I'm just curious, like the interview process, like what are you thinking about as you're conducting interviews? And do you see things that you'd like to see change in our industry about how interviews are done?
I have the awareness that interviewing is difficult on both sides. It's hard to find that one person that is the perfect fit for your team. And on the other side, it's hard to find the one role that you're going to do best at, that you're going to succeed. So I understand why it's easy to fall back on data structures and algorithms and leak code and hacker rank, because those are like easy signals. But those bias towards a certain type of engineer, and that's fine. But if you as the hiring manager or as a company say, this is what we need. We need the hacker. We need the person who likes to dig in and solve problems in that way. Great. That's fine. But that is a very specific type of person. And a lot of us don't fill that bucket. And I wish as an industry we'd adapt a bit more to understanding there are different types of engineering. There's different types of engineering. And we should try to interview for that. One thing that I practice what I preach is I push to not use data structures or algorithms in my interviews or even partner teams interviews. I don't believe in the necessity. But I don't believe like that's the best signal that's going to tell me if someone's going to be successful in Netflix or not. During the interview, might there be something that you have to reach for an algorithm, or you'll have to have some knowledge of a data structure like a tree or a graph in order to succeed? Probably. And that's fine. But even saying data structures and algorithms scares off so many people and it hits their confidence. Like, oh, I didn't graduate. I graduated from boot camp, or I'm self-taught. You're almost immediately excluding all of those people. So I make sure that's not a word that's mentioned in our interviews. If they come up, sure. That's fine. If they come up during the interview and you can reach for it, absolutely, that's fine. But I try to set the standard where that's not how we measure. And another thing I do try to do is I think interviews should be difficult. Again, we are offering, at least a lot of companies we work for, we're offering life-changing roles. We're offering roles that you'll have such a big impact that you may not be able to achieve at other places. So yeah, the interview should be difficult because there's a lot of people. But it doesn't mean the interview should be insulting. It should be a challenge. Ideally, when I think about engineering, it should always be that balance of comfort and challenge. And you should always try to stay on that edge. Because if you're too comfortable, you're not learning anything. You get lazy, you get sloppy, you get bored. And if you're too challenging, you get burnt out. So ideally, what we try to strive is like that right middle. And that's what we try to go for interviews as well. It should be challenging. But at the end of the day, success or failure, you should be like, I did my best work. I showed up as best I could. And it was a good experience all around, even if I didn't get it. And that's really what I think all interviews should strive to be. The reason why it's not that way is because that takes a lot of work. I've put probably 30, 50 hours into this interview for one person. I'm only going to hire one person out of all these hundreds of people. I'm going to hire one person. And I've put in a lot of time. My team is probably putting 100 hours into like making sure the questions are laid out properly. Because like we really care about giving everybody a good experience, whether they pass or not. But I understand not everybody has that luxury or wants to focus the time. And that's where we end up with these horror stories about mass interviews and algorithms and questions like that. Because it's easier. Like being honest, it's just easier to do that than it is to put in a lot of work into it.
I know we're wrapping up here. Real quick question on that, though, because this comes up a lot as I talk with new folks. Is your interview process going to be more of just on pure development concepts, or is understanding cloud concepts part of that? Or is that something that completely abstracted away from your teams where, you know, they don't have to worry about cloud, that's DevOps? What's your angle on that side? Because it really depends on the company, I find.
I think for my team particularly, what I look for is someone who's a bit of a buffet-style engineer. As in, they've walked down that buffet of technologies and stacks and has a bit of experience in a lot of things, because you don't need to know how the cloud computing works or how containers work or how packets move from one node to the next. But I expect you to have some level of awareness at a really basic level of how that works. None of this should be a surprise. At Netflix, we have the concept of the paved road, which we're moving increasingly towards, which is... yeah, you can build how you want. We totally support that. You want to build your own Kubernetes cluster, bespoke, that's fine. But we'll let you do that. We don't encourage that, though, because we have this paved road of we have a company, or we have our own containerization service. We have a team that runs that. So we really encourage people to stay on that road. But you can go off it if you want. So, Dan, to answer your question, no, I don't expect a lot of knowledge of cloud computing or things like that, but you should have some awareness. Yeah, like concepts like Nginx or routing rules or how transport layers work. You don't need to be an expert, but you should generally know at this level about what those things are and the implications of them.
So, John, one of the things I like about AG Grid, which is a data grid component for the kind of complex grid scenarios that we encounter all the time in enterprise apps. One of the things I really like about it is that it works for a variety of frameworks, Angular, React, Vue, or just vanilla JS. Does that ring a bell for you?
Oh, it really does. There's all these different companies that I work with where they have no choice but to use a lot of these different tools because they have different teams working on them. So being able to port their code or share that code and that technical investment they have is really important to them.
Yeah, well, it's important to us. Ideally, we're a consulting company, and you know, we never know what our client's going to want to use, Angular, React, or Vue, but they're all going to need a grid, and it's great to be able to reach for the one grid that works everywhere, AG Grid.
You know, at any size company, too, because you could have these teams that maybe they only use one framework, but eventually they're going to switch to another one and be able to take that investment again and use it, reuse it, is really nice.
So if a multi-framework grid makes sense to you, you should certainly go over there and check out AG Grid at ag-grid.com and tell them Warden John sent you.
Jim, it's been a really good discussion for us today. And before we get a chance to wrap up, because we're getting close to the end of the time, I want to make sure that you've had a chance to kind of share your thoughts, because I know there were a couple other topics that you wanted to touch on today as well. Did you get a chance to kind of get everything out, or is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience?
No, I think we lived up to the promise of we would go in multiple threads and we would see which direction we take on. I apologize. We didn't even talk about WebAssembly at all. I think that was the original intent when you invited me on. But no, I thank you all for the discussion. I think even you asking me some challenging questions forces me to think on the moment about what do I believe? What does my team believe? What is the culture? And that's why I'm on these things, because you push me in a new direction. So I appreciate the ability to be on the show, and thank you all for the questions.
We appreciate you being here. And for those of you out there who haven't heard of Frontend Happy Hour, definitely go check it out. We dropped some links in there. You can hear more from Jem and Ryan Holt. And is Ryan Burgess still a co-host of Frontend Happy Hour as well?
Ryan Burgess does all the work. He does the editing, right, the mixing, the releasing, the Twitter account. I am the worst. We're all the worst. Like, Ryan does 100% of the work, and I just show up and go on rants.
Well, those you are three of my favorite people, so I love having, and all of you have been on our show. We appreciate that, because you just have such great real-world experience. And one of the things I'd like to also let our audience know about is that there's a ton of great content out there. Jem won't talk about it, but I will, that he and his colleagues have put up on Frontend Masters and other places as well. But definitely check out Frontend Masters. Jem, I've watched some of his courses and Brian Holt's courses as well up there. So great content to check out. And with that, we'd like to end our show with a final thought for our audience. And this could be on topic or anything off topic. Since today, our topics went all across the board, nothing is off topic. So with that, I want to start with Ward Bell, the man who's never stayed on topic. What is your final thought for our audience?
And strangely enough, my final thought is on topic.
We're in the twilight zone today.
You know, I was thinking, Jem, you were saying, I've got a position that with hundreds of people applying for it. If I knew that and I thought I wanted that position, and wondered whether I was actually had the technical chops for that or something like that, but still thought I should take a swing at this. I think the thing that people who interview with me anyway don't do, that you listeners should know, is you want that position, go learn everything about what Jem wants ahead of time. Know what Netflix, what his problem set is, how Jem looks at the world. These people are, the people you're interviewing with are not hard to find. The things they care about are not hard to find. If the topic is about X and you don't know anything about X, go find all of the different conflicts and ideas there are about that. And then the follow-up is that when you're in the interview, it's not to parade your knowledge of something you don't know. It's to have become equipped with an understanding of what the concerns are, what you think they might be, and ask good questions of Jem that show you have done your homework. You are an active, open listener, and an active listener has made an investment in the interview on their side, not just showing up. That's my advice to you who is trying to win 1 out of 100 slots, you know, of Jem's time. There you go. That's my thought.
That's great. And Dan, what are your final thoughts for today?
My final thought was, that was an awesome final thought, Ward. that one's tough to follow, actually. I'm going to circle back to, and we talked about this the last recording, at least that I was on, we did. You mentioned, Jem, that, you know, you can teach people to code and they can learn those skills, but sometimes it's a little harder on the communication side, especially when it comes to, one of the key things that stood out, you mentioned, was compromise and being able to work with other groups when things just don't match up perfectly. And that's such an important skill that I'll admit early on, and you've mentioned a couple of times, Jem, that, you know, in your younger years, you might have been a little different, and I definitely was, where if somebody didn't agree, I just pretty much let them know that they're wrong and this isn't going to work and, you know, whatever. And over the years, I hopefully have gotten better at that. But I'd offer as well that those that are interested in these type of roles, or really just in your role today, that's just such an important skill to be able to compromise with people, find the win-win scenarios, and you know, figure it out. Work with what you have and figure it out. So that's my final thought.
Thanks for sharing that, Dan. And Craig, what is your final thought for our audience?
So I think I'm going to build on what Ward said and just offer a few practical examples from my own life of how I did similar types of things. So one job I was going for, sorry, it was a developer relations position. And they were bringing me on to kind of do podcasting and you know, social media type of stuff for the company. And so what I did was I created a sample podcast of what things might sound like when I walked into the interview so that, you know, they could see what they were getting if they were to choose me. A role before that, it was for a consulting company. I had already had a relationship with this consulting company. I knew their framework. I knew their developers. I knew the people. But I didn't let that stop me from also walking into saying, okay, this is the industry that you're in. This is your clients that you're in. Here are six different areas of business or controls or, you know, additions to your framework that you could add to what you're already providing. And, you know, they weren't the best ideas in the entire world, but it gave me an opportunity to show that I was at least thinking through these things and trying to be different than everyone else. So for what it's worth.
That's great advice, actually, Craig. And thank you for learning how to use your microphone. We can stick that in there. I'm only putting that on the air because Craig is the most professional audio person I've ever met in my life. So to see two times this week, he's had audio issues. It makes me feel better inside about myself.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
And Jim, what's your final thought for our audience today?
I know Dan Ward, Craig, you've all made excellent points. We've kind of hit on a lot of areas, though. I don't know how we landed on hiring. To be clear, I am not here promoting a role for my team. That's not what I do. But if we're going to talk about hiring, because that's important, I'll reference what John said earlier about developer relations, but it applies to everybody, is be authentic. The goal of an interview is to suss out who you actually are and how you actually interact. And if you're not authentic in your interactions or you may exaggerate about your technology abilities, we'll find out. And because that's the point. But in general, I think we could all be a bit more authentic. This is more of a hot take, and Ward, I did promise you a hot take, but Twitter is probably the worst because it's either people who are expressing opinions that they know will be inflammatory, but they'll get a lot of responses and a lot of fame from that. Or it's just people just dunking on other people because, again, you'll get a lot of responses from that. It's people like you, John, who I follow on Twitter, who have genuine, authentic interactions. You're like, this sucks, or this is good, this is bad. Here's what I did today. Those are the people that, in the long term, over months and years, you come to respect because they're just being honest with themselves. So I encourage that with everybody. And with the actual topic of today, which was how do we talking about technology and how do we choose it, be critical. We should always be critical. And critical doesn't mean mean. And it doesn't mean overly happy either. It's that you approach things with some skepticism, but not in a negative way, just in a, okay, what if someone's telling me about the technology, what's their motivation behind it? Are they just glossing over these big warts and just focusing on the good things? But it applies to anything in life, like reading the news, reading anything, understand the motivations behind it. And I think we could all be a little bit better if we were a bit more critical of ourselves and the choices we make when it comes to technology.
Well, you've all had such great final thoughts. I feel for you, Dan, as well, what you were saying. It's hard to follow up on all these. My general thought today for everybody is this, that there's a lot of great advice on this particular episode. I've really, really enjoyed this one. And it's no secret that when we get great people on like Jim, who's just so genuine and open, one of these kind of things happen. And one of the reasons I'd like to share that here is one thing I miss is not being able to go out to events and meet people. Twitter doesn't offer this. And one of the reasons I like events and companies, this is hard to put tangible, but companies don't get this all the time. Going to an event like where I first met you, Jim, I think it was in Atlanta somewhere. We went to an event. I forget the name of the event. I didn't know Jim very well. I listened to podcasts once or twice. We sat at a table together and I find that sometimes you meet people that are just so knowledgeable yet humble and open-minded, such as yourself, that I learn so much. It actually teaches me about how to think about technology. Because sometimes we think, wow, this person works on Netflix's massive web API and UI structure. And let's face it, Netflix is ahead of their time, 10 years ago, building a lot of this stuff. So it's been very forward-leaning. But never at any time I talked to you or Ryan, for that matter, from Netflix, where I've gotten the feeling that you always knew better, or you knew the way to go, or you were close-minded on how things should be. It always seems like you're open to listening to ideas and moving forward. And that's the thing I miss from these events is I have met people in this industry. Ward is another great example. I met Ward at an event 12 to 15 years ago. And I never would have met this person with these great ideas if I didn't get out there and put myself out on the line and try to meet new people. Dan and I also met at an event, oddly enough, even before then. So it's just fascinating what you can learn by getting out and meeting people. So as much as I love remote work and sticking in my dark room for the last year and a half and being with my family, I want to encourage you all to, when things are available for you and you're comfortable with it, to try to make those connections out there with new people and try to meet folks and do less talking and more listening and try to see what other people are actually doing and what they're actually accomplishing. We can learn a lot about ourselves and how we can move forward in technology. And that's a piece of the tech industry, I think, has been lost in this last year and a half to nobody's fault because of our situation in the world. So a lot of deep thoughts today from everybody on this podcast. Jim, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. You're always welcome back. I feel like we could just give you the mic and we could just be quiet and you could go on for 45 minutes and be better than all of us. So thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity and letting me go on long rants and tangents. And big plus one to your closing thought there, that I miss talking to people in person. I'm not knocking remote work. I think it has its benefits, but there is something about just looking someone in the eye and understanding them. And hopefully if we learn anything from the events of 2020 and going on is, yeah, talk to people who don't look like you and don't sound like you and don't think like you, because you will be better for it. And it's the hardest thing we do as humans is to find someone who disagrees with us and listen to their perspective. But it's what we got to do.
We do. And I was going to say a funny joke about me and Ward, but I'm going to let it go right there because I think your point was even better said. But I want to thank you again for coming on. Thank our hosts for being here. Thank you for everybody for listening to this episode and for our sponsors for keeping us on the air. Without our sponsors and our audience, we wouldn't exist. And we really enjoy bringing these talks to all of you. So in yet another week, WebRush is over and you'll hear from us every Thursday morning. See you next time.